Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on air. On tonight's program, what is the 7-minute workout for complete fitness?
The concept behind this is that you can include strength training and aerobic training at the same time.
Plus, we learn how some local American doctors are making an impact on women's health and education in Sierra Leone, Africa.
What we'll be doing is specifically developing a much better obstetrical program for them. Right now, there's one OBGYN for the entire country.
And how a new effort promises to protect developing fetuses from the harmful effects of drugs.
Not every baby born to a mom who's addicted will go through neonatal abstinence syndrome, but the numbers that do experience a set of symptoms. Basically, the baby's going through withdrawal.
We'll get our checkup from the neck up and hear from our healing muse. That's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we learn how some local American doctors are making an impact on women's health and education in Sierra Leone, Africa. Plus, how a new effort promises to protect developing fetuses from the harmful effects of drugs. But first, what is the 7-minute workout for complete fitness? And does it work? Exercise science is a growing and fascinating subject, but how can you put some of their new discoveries to work in your daily life? Well, here with some answers is Dr. Carol Sames, Associate Professor in the College of Health Professions and the Director of the Vitality Fitness Program at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Carol. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Linda.
So a recent article in the May-June issue of the American College of Sports Medicine Health and Fitness Journal attempted to give us just that, turning fitness science into a prescription for daily use. What did they say in this article that was so kind of revolutionary?
Well, essentially, we know what the usual guidelines are. 150 minutes of moderate activity a week, 75 minutes of higher intensity activity. And if you look at people's barriers, reasons for not exercising, the number one issue is time. So what these investigators said was, is there a way that we can kind of shrink down the amount of time but still yield benefits? And so hence the 7-minute workout.
So that's what the title of this flashy article was.
Correct.
7 minutes, you can get it all in.
Well, essentially, it's 7 minutes for one circuit, and they'd like you to do 2 to 3 of them.
So there's a little in the fine print.
Correct.
There's fine print there.
Absolutely. But the whole premise of it is that if individuals say they don't have enough time, can we decrease the amount of time, increase the intensity to still yield benefit? And that's essentially what this workout is about. It's about interval training, which has been around for years, but just packaged slightly differently.
So it's high-intensity interval training, which is
yes.
The key. Help us understand what that means. What's the concept behind it?
So the concept behind this is that you can include strength training and aerobic training at the same time, as opposed to, say, I go walk on the treadmill and then I do my strength training later. This combines everything into one. It takes less time, but it's high intensity, which means I have an elevated heart rate. I'm not going to feel real happy while I'm doing this. On an exertion scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being extreme, difficult, this is going to be around an 8. So I'm not carrying on a conversation while I'm doing this.
So it's basically, there's a lot of discomfort or steady discomfort in this series of exercises.
Right.
With interval rests.
Right. And the interval rests are short. They're 10 seconds. They're short. It's 30-second bout of exercise and then 10-second rest, with the whole idea that you don't want to rest too much, because if you rest too much, you lose some of those metabolic changes that can occur with minimal rest.
So let's talk about why is it becoming so popular, this HICT or high-intensity interval training? Why is it becoming so popular? Is it because of what you said, that people don't have time, this is a time saver, and they can get it all in at, you know, in a relatively short amount of time? The other feature I'm also noticing with these exercises, and we'll get to what they are, is that there's no equipment. You don't have to be in a gym. You basically can be have a chair and be in your room and you know, be able to do them all. So that could also be another barrier.
Absolutely. In fact, it's a tremendous benefit to have people be able to exercise at home. Think about all the time driving to a facility, trying to wedge that into your day. So
or waiting for being in a gym and waiting for a piece of equipment to be available.
Another good point.
Yeah. So what though? I mean, there's also good scientific data that shows that this kind of high-intensity interval training really makes changes.
It does. So structurally, you can see individuals lose body fat because there are changes in some chemicals, catecholamines for one, increase in growth hormone. Because it's high intensity, a lot of these changes even persist 2 to 3 days after the exercise. An improvement in insulin use, which certainly with type 2 diabetes on the rise, that's important. It does increase your aerobic capacity, something that we call VO2 max, my ability to utilize oxygen and do more activity. And then it also increases my muscular fitness because part of this circuit training is strength, a resistance training. So
there are really demonstrable changes in our body as a result of undertaking this. So it's not just the time-saving idea or the fact that you don't have a gym membership that you have to pay for or any of these things. The fact is this type of exercise really is superior, perhaps, to others?
Well, if I was a runner and I wanted to compete at a high level as a runner, then this would not be the only type of training. Obviously, training is specific. But if you're just looking at I want to improve some cardio and strength, you get a lot of bang for your buck here.
Well, let's talk about what exactly is involved in this so-called 7-minute workout, which is really a misstatement because they're really talking about doing 2 to 3 of these circuits. But there are 12 exercises. So let's do a very, very brief run through of what they are. But let me just say to our listeners, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with exercise physiologist Dr. Carol Sames. We're talking about this so-called 7-minute workout. So what's in the 7-minute workout? And one last question. Do they have to be done in this order?
Yes, the order is important. It doesn't have to be these specific 12 exercises. There could be some different combinations, but the order is important because you want to work large muscle groups. You want to alternate muscle groups because otherwise you're going to kind of get fatigued if I do all my leg activities all at once. So there is a little method to that madness.
So we start with jumping jacks.
Right.
Which everyone knows what those are, basically.
We've probably all done jumping jacks in our lives.
And how many do you do?
It's 30 seconds. So it's what can be accomplished in 30 seconds. And then 10-second rest. Then you move to wall sits.
And a wall sit is what?
It's essentially like a squat, but you do it up against the wall. It helps with form because your back is up against the wall, and you are absolutely going to feel that in your quadriceps.
So you stay stationary against a wall,
right,
in a squat.
Like you're sitting in a chair that's not there.
And that's a 30-second interval.
Correct. And then 10 seconds off.
And then two?
Push-ups. Another great all-body, upper-body, core activity.
And if you're unable to do a full push-up, can you do
modified,
sissy push-up?
No, not sissy at all. Modified push-up. This is where modification is important. Or you can even do wall push-ups.
Okay, so then you do 30 seconds of a push-up,
right,
a 10-second break, and then?
Crunches.
Abdominal crunches.
So you can see we've gone from arm to core. And then step up. So stepping up on a chair. And obviously you'd want this chair to be sturdy, flat surface. You know, I'm going to step up on the lazy boy. Probably not a great idea. So just step ups.
Step up, step down.
Correct.
For 30 seconds.
Yes.
Okay. And then a 10-second rest and then a different kind of a squat.
Yes, then an actual full squat, which from a functional standpoint is excellent because it really engages all those muscles that we need to walk, to climb stairs, to go
downstairs.
So without
the help of a wall, you're just squatting,
right,
with your arms out in front of you.
Exactly.
And then?
And then using that same chair, but putting your arms on the chair with your legs out in front of you, it's essentially triceps, which is the muscle on the back of your upper arm. And you push down and come back up.
So you do a triceps dip, so to speak. In other words, you're out in front of the chair.
Yes.
The chair is behind you.
You're
holding on to the chair, and you lower your body down with the only your arms supporting you.
Correct.
Okay, so that gets through triceps. Again, another break of 10 seconds, and then a 30-second
plank.
To the plank.
Yes, and Planks are obviously upper body, back, trunk, core, and 30 seconds of planks, that can be challenging. The important thing to note with these exercises is form is extraordinarily important. And so you'd really want to be able to watch somebody. If they couldn't do a real plank, we'd want to modify it, because it does you no good to do it incorrectly. You're just asking to hurt yourself.
And then, just very briefly, let's get to the last four. One is high knee stepping in place.
Right.
Then the next one with a break in between is a
lunge. Another, again, wonderful functional activity.
Where you're basically stepping down to almost a kneeling position.
Correct.
With
your
one
back
leg.
Nice and straight, yep. Yes. And then a push-up and rotation. Again, you can see this is upper body and core. Mm-hmm. And then the last is a side plank. So instead of being up on your forearms, you're on the side.
But all this, what's important here is these are all, in a way, somewhat stationary, except for the jumping jacks and maybe the abdominal crunch. A lot of these are you're holding yourself in place.
Right, body
so they're
weight.
They're somewhat isometric.
Some of them are very isometric, yes, which can be a problem for individuals, for instance, that have high blood pressure. You know, we want to be very careful with isometric activity with individuals that have known cardiovascular disease and hypertension.
So I guess that's what I would get back to here. So let's say we go through all these 12. You have another 10 seconds in between the 12th and then number one again. And they're talking about doing this 2 to 3 times.
Yes.
I can see why there's a lot of discomfort.
Yes. This is, again, it's high intensity. It's not a misnomer.
But would this, if you did only this, would this also increase your aerobic capacity in the same way as perhaps running or bicycling or cross-country skiing or other things might do?
It does increase your VO2 max, your cardiovascular ability to perform activity. Again, if I was a cyclist, I obviously would want to be specific in my training. But for the average person, and that's what, again, makes this appealing, the shorter period of time, the fact that it's convenient, I don't need a lot of resources, and I can still yield physiological benefits.
So let's say you can't use this program exactly. Or let me back up before we go to that. What are the contraindications? Who should not be using this kind of a program?
Okay. So anybody with known cardiovascular disease, this intensity is just too high. Anybody who is sedentary, they haven't even begun an exercise program, this is not the place to start. There are going to be chronic diseases where this is just not the activity. If you have some significant hand osteoarthritis or rheumatoid arthritis, with all of the hand activities here, this is...
And all the weight bearing on your
right,
hands.
Right, that's just not going to be the right activity. But the take-home message here is that we know that intervals are beneficial, and so we might need to increase the amount of rest. We might need to alter the activity, but you know, interval training can be very beneficial. And just because I have cardiovascular disease doesn't mean that I can't adapt interval training. This specific program, not for me, but an adaptation of it, yes.
So that was, you actually just went into my next question. So if you couldn't use it exactly, how would you get help with this kind of thing? I mean, I know your Vitality program is out there helping people figure out how they can adapt programs to their own needs. But, you know, average Joe decides they want to really get in shape and they've been doing something, but maybe not this kind of thing. Where would they turn?
You know, the first thing is I would actually talk to my healthcare professional and say, you know, am I cleared to do this? This is what I'd like to do. And then to always remember to start slowly. You know, it didn't take me 10 years of not a whole lot of activity to get to this point. It's not going to, you know, I'm not going to change that in a week as much as I'd love to. So understand that I want to start slowly. You know, this might not be the exact program for me, but I can modify this and I can still receive benefits.
So I guess the question is, if you could only do the 7 minutes every day, would you still, because this has been the controversy we talk about a lot, and I don't want to run out of time, so I want your answer on this. Is anything better than nothing?
Absolutely.
And so this that's being discussed is really kind of maybe your ideal. But
right.
If you can't do this, anything, even in intervals, could be helpful.
Absolutely. In fact, as we were chatting, some of these exercises are something that I'd like everybody to do. Those wall sits, lunges, push-up, even if we have to modify it, they're fantastic. Everybody can do those in some way, shape, or form. the step up, step down, they're fantastic. They're very functional. They're using muscles that we need to just move around and do activities of daily living. So absolutely, anything is better than nothing.
Well, I think that's bottom line takeaway, but this whole idea of interval training is exciting, and the fact that you can get more bang for your buck by doing it is very exciting. Carol, once again, you're always so informative. Thank you for coming. My guest has been Dr. Carol Sames. She's associate professor in the College of Health Professions. She's the director of the Vitality Fitness Program at Upstate Medical University. Once again, pleasure seeing you.
Thank you, Linda.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Coming up next, a new partnership for women's health and education in Africa. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Well, there's always a global need in third world countries for help in the delivery of adequate healthcare services. One organization, Worldwide Healing Hands, has recently initiated a program in partnership with Upstate Medical University to benefit women's health and education in Sierra Leone in West Africa. Well, here with more on this is Dr. Robert Silverman, professor and chair of obstetrics and gynecology at Upstate Medical University and Krauss Hospital, and the division chief of maternal and fetal medicine as well. Welcome, Dr. Silverman. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So you've, Upstate and you, have initiated a brand new partnership with this Worldwide Healing Hands. Tell us about it.
Well, we're very excited about this partnership. Worldwide Healing Hands, it turns out, is funded and established by one of our graduates from our residency program.
Really?
Who is living in California and has been very involved in global health care, especially in East Africa, East and West Africa both. And Dr. Donda, who is the physician involved with that, has reached out to Upstate Medical University and the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology to partner with her in addressing a major problem in Sierra Leone.
Tell us about what is the problem and what are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, one of the problems is Sierra Leone has the dubious distinction of being one of the most poverty-stricken nations in the world. It's actually the lowest-ranked nation in the world. And what's happened is the maternal mortality rate, deaths related to obstetrical issues, is on the range of 2% of all women.
Wow.
Which, when you think about that, the idea that one out of every 50 women who go to have a baby dies is just...
staggering.
It's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. It really is. So what is the hope? What is this program that you plan to... What's the partnership? What will you be doing?
What we'll be doing is specifically developing a much better obstetrical program for them. Right now, there's one OBGYN for the entire country.
Come on.
And that's it.
That's shocking.
Which is amazing when you think about it. They have a medical school, but what they need is the establishment of an accelerated program in obstetrics to address the issues that are most commonly causing deaths in their country. And those are things like the performance of a cesarean section, the management of hemorrhage, DNC for sepsis, those kinds of things that right now, these women just die because of that problem. And so what we want to accomplish is an accelerated training program for some of their medical school graduates in order to begin to train a cadre of physicians that can deal with these problems.
So you would basically be going over training medical students in OBGYN to fulfill those needs.
We're going to take the recent graduates from medical school, and that's exactly what we'll end up doing. We'll create a curriculum so that whether it's physicians from Upstate or part of Doctors Without Borders, whoever ends up going over there to assist them will be able to use a curriculum to train them in all of these different issues.
So basic surgical skills, recognition and treatment of all these common obstetrical issues. And it's how long will this program go on for?
Well, we originally want to accelerate it over the course of a year, but our hope is that we'll be able to identify those people that really have potential and bring that out for another couple of years and fully train them in obstetrics and gynecology.
Do they have the physical infrastructure? I mean, do they have places where all of this can take place in sterile environments? And you know, are there hospitals per se?
It really is a challenge. And they're beginning to develop some of the infrastructure. And I think there's no question that further development is necessary. But this can be done without a lot of technology. In fact, most of these nations, what you end up doing is being very low tech, yet you can have large impact.
And they already probably have some lower level, like midwife type of people also in place that can be trained as well.
That's indeed the case. They have a lot of mid-level, lower level providers within their villages and within certain areas, but they don't have the high level support. And that's where the problems arise.
So who would actually be going? I don't mean specific names of people, but give us an example.
Well, we would want to use some of the upstate faculty. We'd also, Helping Hands also has a whole cadre of physicians that they use, and partnerships with Doctors Without Borders, OBGYNs throughout the world.
So it's not just these kinds of procedures, but it's also women's health education that's going to be brought to them as well.
Actually, the education is the biggest part of it. And I think that when you consider that you have a country with one OBGYN for the entire country, there's obviously a huge need for education. And, you know, education not only physicians, but patients, of providers, to even know when to send them so that we can prevent the deaths and tremendous mortalities and morbidities.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on air. I'm Linda Cohen here with obstetrician gynecologist Dr. Robert Silverman. We're talking about a new partnership to bring improved women's health services to West Africa. Well, it seems to me like this is a major undertaking. How will you get will you need equipment, that kind of thing, that you'll be bringing as well?
Well, I think there are some equipment needs, but the overwhelming majority of this is a knowledge base, and having a curriculum that we develop, and I think more of programming than anything else, many of the things that we teach can be done with very low-tech equipment. It doesn't require a lot of very expensive equipment. There certainly are some needs that we have, but most of it is just having people available and a curriculum to teach their physicians how to take care of women.
The sad news right now is that we are in the midst in West Africa, and specifically in Sierra Leone as well, of a very significant outbreak of Ebola. And in recent weeks, it's been talked about literally spinning out of control. So I understand that for the time being, this program has been postponed.
Understandably, because there's no question that the Ebola crisis is critical and is overshadowing everything that's happening in West Africa.
Yeah, I mean, we're hearing so much about healthcare workers being at risk, but it seems to me that it even more underscores the unstable health systems in Africa's poorest countries.
No question about it. When you're dealing with extreme poverty and you're dealing with people who don't understand the basics of infection and why things like Ebola get spread throughout populations, there's no question that it is a crisis and it's very difficult to contain.
Have you yourself been involved in any of these types of programs before this?
I have not.
These kinds of global health problems.
Yeah, no, I have not. This for me is a venture that makes a lot of sense, because certainly I've been invested with teaching through the medical school with both medical students as well as residents in obstetrics and gynecology. And as part of the regional perinatal program, we service 19 different hospitals in upstate New York over 14 different counties. So this has been very much a emphasis of my career.
It seems to me, as we look at this whole problem in West Africa, though, the need is so great, and your program obviously will potentially fill a need. But do you have some thoughts about how some of, you know, first world countries, so to speak, could be making more of an impact in these countries and preventing something like this Ebola outbreak from ever getting, you know, legs, so to speak?
Well, I think there's a moral obligation that many of us have in education to spread our knowledge throughout the world. Many of us don't know how to do it. We don't have partnerships, but I think there's a need for us to do this. And, you know, it's interesting. You take something that has a 2% mortality rate, and even if you cut it by a third, it has such a tremendous outcome change in families and in lives of people. I can't change a 2% mortality rate, but I can certainly impact on it and make a difference. And I think all of us can do that.
So what's going to happen now with the current situation? Obviously, we don't really know how long this Ebola outbreak will continue and if, in fact, it will become epidemic throughout West Africa. And beyond.
And that's the concern, is because of the level of poverty, because of the lack of healthcare providers as well as facilities, this has the potential of becoming a larger and larger crisis and going globally.
Do you think that right now healthcare professionals are somewhat reluctant to do this kind of important work, given what we've been seeing? So many now have been infected. We have lost, I guess, a certain number who have actually died. And I think you were saying people who are Ebola experts in the world, we've lost many of those.
We have. This is a virus that truly has a lot of implications for healthcare providers. And there's no question that practicing medicine in developing countries can potentially be dangerous. But on the other hand, the global impact that we can make and using preventative measures and being careful can help to mitigate a lot of the problems that can occur with educating and being part of a third world nation's healthcare process.
Something as simple as I was reading about the fact that there's suspicion of hospitals in these third world countries to begin with, and thinking that when these diseases spread, that they actually are being spread within a hospital. That's one thing. I guess there has been threats to burn down hospitals during this whole Ebola outbreak. And the whole way, for example, that they treat their dead, and which you can understand the feeling of kind of a ritual washing of the body and all that, but not having any understanding that they are literally, you know, perpetuating the spread of the disease. It's frightening.
It is, and yet that's the problem in many poverty-stricken nations, is a lack of education. And I think, you know, we're always afraid of that which we don't understand. So our job is to make people understand what the problem is in a way that makes sense to them and on a level that they can understand. We have to do that.
It sounds like America is beginning to take the lead. I mean, with the CDC and the government is looking at the fact, I believe, that we'll be sending troops over to build infrastructure, not necessarily to treat individuals with, you know, with regard to Ebola, but specifically to actually build the infrastructure necessary to quarantine and care for patients so that we can possibly limit the spread and also save some people.
And I think that's the right direction. There's no doubt in my mind that the biggest problem with many of the developing nations is a lack of infrastructure, and we're good at that. And so helping these nations, not just doing it ourselves, but helping them to develop their infrastructure is something that we can offer to them that can have just a tremendous impact.
So what is your plan going forward at this point without knowing what the future holds? What's the hope? What's the expectation?
Well, our
in
hope
terms
is,
of this program.
Sure. Our hope is that the healthcare crises that are ongoing currently in Sierra Leone will resolve in a fairly rapid fashion. Whether or not that's possible is another story. But in the meantime, we continue to go forward with our planning and development of how we'd like to do the educational processes so that when things have stabilized and we're able to get things going, that we're ready to take off and be running on the program.
Well, I wish you the best of luck. I hope you'll come back and share with us, you know, hopefully it won't be too long in the future, what's transpired and some of your successes is what I hope. My guest has been Dr. Robert Silverman. He's professor and chair of obstetrics and gynecology at Upstate Medical University and the division chief of maternal and fetal medicine. Thanks again for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from a neck up, what I did with my summer vacation, or evolutionary psychology, and yow! Well, folks, in a few weeks, I will have been at this psychology business over 30 years, 36 if we include grad school. Yow! One would think that after all that time, I'd have discovered a few things to pass along. One would, but... All right. I've learned a few things. And here's what I've learned. Number one, I am a giant blob of protoplasm. And no offense meant, but so are you. As such, we have some specialized protoplasmic subblobs, if you will, that see, hear, smell, taste, touch the world around. And to make sense of all this incoming info, we have another top-of-the-heap subblob called the noodle, the brain, the cabbage. And evolutionarily speaking, these subblobs evolved to detect threats to our blobbiness, perhaps other blobs nearby looking to add to their blobbiness at our expense. That is, eat us. Yeah, no, Mr. Blob, no. Now, our specialized subblobs do well perusing the right in front of us and sending out alarming yows when they sense the end is nearby. The problem is that while we are perusing the nearby, we often fail to see the bigger picture, causing ourselves unnecessary alarm and distress. For example, my alarming yow, look out, comes from focusing narrowly on the number 36, thinking my giant blob is old and maybe headed to blob heaven soon, but I'm missing the big picture, which, if I shift my perspective to the larger context, is that my father blob lived to 78 and my mother blob is still blobbing along at 97, and I never smoked like my father blob did for years, so I'm likely to keep blobbing along just fine for quite some time yet. Seeing the big picture is often a relief. And figuring all that out is what I've done with my summer vacation. I'm Dr. Rich. See the big picture. O'Neill, thanks for tuning in.
Next up, a new effort to protect developing fetuses from the dangers of drugs. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen. Here's our Healthy Monday Minute for this week. Get fit by walking. The minimum 30 minutes of exercise required daily for a healthy lifestyle doesn't necessarily entail a vigorous workout session at a state-of-the-art facility. Walking is a simple exercise that is proven to be effective in weight loss. Additional to weight loss, walking also helps to lower cholesterol, reduces the risk of type 2 diabetes, increases bone strength, and improves circulation. If you've been sedentary, start walking 3 times a week at a stroll for 20 minutes. Work your way up to 5 or 6 times a week, 30 minutes per session, for a total of 2.5 to 3 hours per week. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Many more babies have been born to mothers who use prescription painkillers during pregnancy over the last decade in this country. And the number of babies born suffering from withdrawal symptoms due to their mother's use of these prescription painkillers more than tripled between 2000 and 2009, according to a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. We'll hear with more on this are Gail Bannock, the Director of Public Education and Communications for the Upstate New York Poisons Center, and Dr. Roberto Martinez. He's the Neonatal Abstinence Program Coordinator for the Onondaga County Health Department and the Lerner Center of Syracuse University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Gail, let me start with you. As a result of this increased usage, we now know that many babies are born addicted to drugs. Tell us more about that.
Well, unfortunately, if you increase availability, you increase access, and therefore you increase the number of people using. I mean, that just seems to make sense. So if the demand is there, you'll see an increase in numbers.
What happens with these babies, though? I mean, why is this of such concern?
Well, the babies, when they're born, go through a set of symptoms. Now, not every baby born to a mom who's addicted will go through neonatal abstinence syndrome. But the numbers that do experience a set of symptoms. And the symptoms vary, but they can include seizures. They can include, oftentimes when I talk to the neonatal nurses, they'll tell me that the babies are uncontrollable and they cry consistently. And
so they're hyper irritable,
yeah,
difficult to soothe.
Mm-hmm. Difficulty breathing. So there really are all kinds of problems, and there's a set of them. And as I said, not every baby experiences the same thing. But it's basically the baby's going through withdrawal.
In other words, they've been addicted as well.
Right. Well, unfortunately, in the world of abuse, the word addicted generally indicates that you've made a choice.
Right. So here,
so
this,
it's chemical dependency is what we refer to it as.
Exactly,
but yes.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they've been chemically dependent on these drugs. Dr. Martinez, what kinds of drugs are we talking about?
We are actually speaking of two main groups, perhaps. A group of women who are using illegal drugs, like marijuana, opioids, cocaine, or the drugs that are on the street, heroin, as the heroin increases in disponibility in our community. But there are also another group of women who are using medication that prescribed medication by their physicians, like to deal with the pain, for example. So both there are two groups that could be categorized: as illegal drug use and non-illegal drug users, just prescription drug users.
But is there a difference when we talk about the effect on the developing fetus as to whether it's prescribed or not?
There is a difference depending on of what drug is being administered or what drug has been used by the mom and the effects that it can cause. However, we should say that the effects on the baby then at the end, even there are some inconclusive studies about some of the drugs. Some other drugs have very conclusive effects on the baby. We could say that there are developmental issues. There are cognition issues in the baby. At the end, what happens is that the quality of life of the baby is diminished as an adult.
So it's compromised in some way. It's just that in some cases we don't have hard data to support what the long-term effects of this kind of addiction, for want of a better term, chemical dependence for the correct usage, we don't really know what the long-term effects are, but the fact is it can't be good.
You got that right.
So why do you think, Gail, why do you think this is happening more now? You mentioned excess or accessibility, and does our local problem reflect what's going on in the country at large?
Well, I think in terms of the usage within the community, I think we have pockets, whether it's Onondaga County, as we talk to the DEA agents, they'll tell you what the drug of choice is, and throughout New York State. There were some Senate hearings that were held recently that senators asked the community to come and provide testimony as to what was going on in the communities, that, and they had invited experts from the community as well as the community personnel. And it was amazing to me as I attended all three of them. The stories might have been a little bit different, but the fact was there was an increased usage. Now, when we look at numbers of, think about, we Americans are about 4.5% of the population of the world, and yet we consume 80% of all the opiates.
Wow.
And we consume
that's staggering.
Yeah, and 99% of all the hydrocodone in the world.
And much of that is prescribed. Mm-hmm. When it comes to things like those are prescription drugs.
Right.
So there's been a lot of talk about the fact that there's been overprescription of those kinds of painkillers, and hence addiction that follows. So in many cases, some of this is not, as you made, I think, a very clear point, Dr. Martinez, some of this is based on perhaps what started out as a real issue with pain and a request in a legal sense by a patient to a physician for help with that, and then an addiction follows, and then obviously if they're pregnant, it has the ramification of affecting the infant, the developing fetus, and that's, is it, would you say it's, what percentage would you say, or how would that break down, or do you may not have that figure, but do you have a sense of where that is in terms of the prescription issue versus the illegal issue?
I don't think we have,
you don't have that
good
data.
Information. However, what we can say is that from the Onondaga County Health the health assessment that was conducted by the Onondaga County Health Department in 2013, what they found is that, like, in 2012, 9% of the women are self-reporting illegal drug use, not the prescribed medication, but illegal drug use. So at least we know that we have a sense of that issue. In terms of the prescribed medication, I think there's less data that we would be able to share at the moment.
Mm-hmm. What's shocking to me, to be perfectly frank, is if you go to see a physician and you are given an opioid for pain, and then you end up addicted to that, one would think if you then became pregnant, all kinds of information would be, you'd be deluged with all kinds of information about, hey, you must somehow stop using that medication because of the potential hazards. Is that not the case in your experience?
It sounds like a perfect
story. Perfectly rational story.
But unfortunately, when you're talking about someone who's addicted,
they find ways.
The addiction takes over. So in many of the women that I've spoken to who are on either Suboxone or Methadone and in programs now, you know, they'll tell me stories of how they would do anything to get the drug and how, although they felt guilty, they didn't see a way out.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, and along with Gail Bannock, she's the Director of Public Education and Communications for the Upstate Poison Center, and Dr. Roberto Martinez, he's the Neonatal Abstinence Program Coordinator for Onondaga County Health Department and the Lerner Center at SU. We're talking about babies born addicted to drugs. Just tell me what's done for them now.
Well, first of all, Linda, I'd just like to point out the numbers because we haven't talked about that.
Please do.
In terms of the number of babies that are born, the studies that we've been looking at are roughly 26 babies born per 1,000 population in Onondaga County, which is the highest in the state. And unfortunately, although I honestly can't say I've done a comparative to in terms of which counties are higher throughout the United States, the number is up there. That's for certain. And so back when Dr. Morrow called attention to this.
Dr. Cynthia Morrow was our health.
With the health commissioner. Right. You really drove this program and initially. And then the good news is the county stepped up with the finances to back it and with the manpower, realizing that this is really a problem. And the hospitals in the area agreed and that it was obviously a priority
for
them.
So what's being done? I mean, obviously you find a baby's born, they've got neonatal abstinence syndrome. What's being done first for the babies and then, of course, for the moms? What's being done currently, medically?
Well, I think the first thing to know is that the clinical dependency or treatment of this dependency, moms are being put into as a priority. So one, a mom is detected to be a user. She can call a couple of phone lines where she's going to receive help. And then she would put in as one of the first on the list to receive, like, treatment. So currently we have about 300 people in the county who are expecting and waiting for treatment, who are not pregnant women, or it could be male, too. So once a mom is recognized, she's put initially
to the head of the line
to receive treatment immediately.
And then, the treatment consists of?
The treatment consists of, like, basically changing or adding another kind, changing the kind of drug that she's using for, like, methadone, for example, which replacement therapy would be one of the therapies used, but Also, counseling services, it's very important. So just to make sure that it's not only a clinical issue, but also making sure that a holistic intervention to the mom, helping her in as many areas as possible in her life.
So if there were social issues driving her, for example, to seek self-medication, you would be dealing with the whole person mm-hmm. and trying to figure out. But this idea of methadone's been used for decades and decades, probably more than 50 years, I think, as a replacement. It is non-addictive, is that correct? It's not non-addictive. It's you don't get a high from it, but it satisfies the craving, I guess. So it's seen as a lesser evil. Mm-hmm. And so that's where they begin with something like a methadone.
Yes, treatment. And you can also start to wean them off the drug little by little, and the effects are going to be less on the mom. And what the drug does is basically just to act on the same receptors in the brain that an illegal drug or even just another kind of medicated drug would use to.
So you're basically helping them get off
by mimicking
the affecting, offending drug. I guess the question, though, is, are you targeting mostly then moms who have not yet delivered or who are in the early stages of the development of the fetus? Or are you also working with moms who have delivered a baby who has this neonatal abstinence, and what happens then? Is it similar?
The exciting news, Linda, is that all the hospitals now are on board. So at least we're starting with a top-down approach, and that there is recognition, whether it's from Senator Schumer's office or the Onondaga County Health Department or working in collaboration with Syracuse University. You know, we have people at the table, shall we say, working with all different groups throughout the county who, first of all, recognize the issue and are willing to put the efforts and the resources behind it to make a difference in the community. So there are many different types of efforts that are, for example, we look at from the DA's task force, the district attorney's office and the members of that committee work with the legislature, and over the course of 2 years, we have now seen a change in pharmacy take-back, amended DEA regulations that are going to allow pharmacies to take back drugs. Huge, as far as I'm concerned. Of course, reducing accessibility, reducing availability will hopefully help to reduce.
So let me just clarify that. I don't want to run out of time.
Sure.
There's so much to talk about. This take-back is if you, as a person, went to a doctor and got a certain opioid prescription and no longer needed it, instead of leaving it in your medicine cabinet, you could take it back to the pharmacy legally and they would take it back from you.
That is the way it's supposed to play out. Unfortunately, right now, there isn't any accountability in the bill for who is going to be responsible for paying for that. But the good news is moving forward. In addition to that, there have been educational opportunities for moms. So we've developed brochures, we've developed posters. So we're working forward, working with the community to help solve the problem.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming in. My guests have been Gail Bannock, the Director of Public Education and Communications for Upstate's New York Poison Center, and Dr. Roberto Martinez. He's the Program Coordinator, the Neonatal Abstinence Program Coordinator for Onondaga County Health Department and the Lerner Center of Syracuse University. Once again, thanks a lot for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Birth can be a joyful moment, an experience to be savored, when the new life first emerges safely into welcoming arms and hearts. Poet Jennifer Richter brings this joy to us in her poem called First Words. It recalls for her son the moments of his birth and the first months after, and why they chose his name. First words. Child, you were light all at once. You did not tunnel toward the bright world waiting. From a small slit, like a crimp in the blinds, they pulled you from me and held you to the sky, held you crying, held you shining, your fair skin lit from the inside, your hair one huge fine red flame. Luke, luminous, We chose the name before we were sure of you, and since you came, our usual season of rain has stayed away. Today, sun strong at our backs, day of the year's longest night, you sit on my lap, wave your arm in the most deliberate gesture I've seen, follow the spread of your fingers across the floor, and just like that, add shadows to what you already know. Already you have a song-like voice, though it has taken 4 months and this moment to coax my first words. Strange, this turning from you to the page, so I wait until I hear the poem whole in my head. Luke, the one who found words for that one birth, that famous star. In this season, son, you live in holy mouths. When you were born, the doctors held you up with arms raised and all our faces tilted to the place blessings come from and names and first words and light. Luke, luminous, your hand in the air is a star. On the floor, our shadow is still one body.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we take a closer look at bladder cancer, that silent killer, and a dramatic surgical therapy to treat it. Plus, how 3D brain-like tissue can help unlock the secrets of brain disorders. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.